sixth case today, United States versus Seller.
No. Astro, Huber versus Astro. Huber versus Astro.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Huber versus Astro. Is that a sixth case?
Yeah. Huber versus Astro, I'm sorry. Repeating the same one.
Good morning. I actually believe it's still morning. Mm-hmm. I'm Marcy Goldblum on behalf of Plaintiff Deborah Huber. This case involves plaintiff's petition for fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act after having secured a remand for Ms. Huber. It's our position that the district court absolutely abused its discretion in finding that the position of the commissioner was substantially justified. And I'd like to start by looking specifically at what the district court said in denying the EJA petition. The district court said, and this is at the appendix at 43, after reviewing the case as a whole, the undersigned is of the opinion that position of the government was substantially justified. To hold otherwise in this case would equate prevailing party status with entitlement to fees, that is not the law. To begin with, I think that the district court's holding there is rather vague and really doesn't provide much guidance to the reviewing tribunal as to what his thought was. But furthermore, it appears that the district court is saying that a holding that a lack of substantial justification can't be premised on the error for which remand was ordered, which seems to be throwing the Equal Access to Justice Act on its ear. 21 years ago in Sullivan versus Hudson, the Supreme Court, in a different context, said that it found it difficult to ascribe to Congress an intent to throw the Social Security claimant a lifeline it knew was a foot short. I would submit that if this definition of substantial justification were to take hold, that in other words, a lack of substantial justification can't be found on the basis of why the case was remanded, that the Equal Access to Justice Act really has no footing at all. But let's go further. What happened in this case was the administrative law judge. The district court noted that the administrative law judge relied on Dr. Howard, who was one of the reviewing psychologists or psychiatrists, PRT, which is the form that addresses the listings, that the ALJ relied on Dr. Howard's PRT report, which conflicted with the other evidence of record, as well as was inconsistent with his mental RFC assessment. The district court noted that it was unclear why the ALJ relied on a form geared to step 3 instead of the form geared to step 4 in terms of formatting RFC. The district court also noted that that was an important failure because what they were looking at that point was Dr. Howard's assessment, particularly as it stood to social functioning. And Dr. Howard made it clear that this was an individual who couldn't interact with other people very well. And the district court noted that most of the VE's jobs require interaction with the general public. But let's even go beyond that. Defendant argues that it was just a lack of articulation. And the commissioner seems to argue time and time again that if all we have is a lack of articulation, that plaintiff should not be able to get fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act, and that's just plain wrong. The cases do not hold that. There are cases, Stein, Cunningham, there are some cases that say that there are times where if the only error is lack of articulation, fees may not be appropriate. But it does not, there's no case law that says that lack of articulation can never be a source of lack of substantial justification.
Well, am I correct that in this case the same doctor rendered contradictory reports about the same person on the same day?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the ALJ doesn't explain at all.
And there's no explanation by the administrative law judge of what the judge relied on.
Exactly. And, in fact, Social Security...
Now, is it possible you could deny any fee because of this weird situation?
I don't think there should be.
It's so strange. How would you decide how to award a fee?
How to award a fee?
In these circumstances.
Justice O'Connor, you're talking about a fee under the Equal Access to Justice Act? Well, here's the thing. Social Security ruling 96-8P says that the ALJ must, not that they should, must explain how any material inconsistencies were considered and resolved. Here, the ALJ absolutely failed to do that. So you have the ALJ who has failed to follow one of the agency's own rulings. And then furthermore, although the district court seems to ignore the fact that there were issues that it hadn't reached in the merits, when we look at step five, there's more error that this ALJ engaged in.
Well, should the case be remanded?
Oh, the case was remanded.
But again?
Well,
where are we?
The case was remanded by the district court,
yes.
And following that remand, the plaintiff filed for EJA fees based on that remand.
Mm-hmm.
The case on its merits, we're not handling that at the administrative stage. My understanding is either that a hearing has just been scheduled or may have recently been held, but I don't know.
You have no report on that?
No, I don't. But what I can tell you is that when the case was remanded by this district court judge, in addition to the issue for which it was remanded, the administrative law judge put in her decision that this person had moderate limitations on concentration, persistence, and pace. She then translated that in her hypothetical question to the vocational expert into routine and repetitive tasks. Now, this court has held repeatedly that the ALJ may not account for limitations in concentration, persistence, and pace by restating the vocational inquiry to simple and routine tasks. Now, the district court judge never got to our step five argument, but in the Stewart case, which I think has a lot of parallels to this case, the court made very clear that when the administrative law judge does what this court has told it time after time after time not to do, in other words, you don't take moderate limitations against concentration, persistence, and pace, and then translate that, particularly without explaining how you're translating it, into just a limitation for simple, routine, repetitive. This court has made it very, very clear in Young, in Kisarsky, that in Smith, in Ramirez, that is contrary to the law of this circuit. And where the administrative law judge fails to follow well-established law, this court has awarded EJA fees, and I think the Stewart case is very telling. If the court has no questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Benz?
Good morning, Your Honors, or good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Julie Benton. I represent the Commissioner of Social Security in this matter. Counsel suggested that the district court made a ruling in its EJA decision that an EJA award cannot be premised on the error for which remand was awarded. That is simply not what the district court found in this case. The EJA award in this case, the court noted that it had examined and thoroughly reviewed the briefs and its own remand order. It stated that it agreed with the plaintiff on only one of the many issues that were raised. It did not say, I agreed with the plaintiff on only one issue, and therefore, as a matter of law, I must deny the EJA fees. a single issue is not determinative, but neither is it irrelevant or insignificant. The court then quoted the basis in its remand decision. Again, this is the same court who issued the EJIA decision and the merits decision, and said this is the one reason on which I remanded. There was a lack of explanation for why the district court accepted this one medical opinion and rejected the inconsistent medical opinion from the same doctor.
Do you think that any different considerations come into play when an ALJ reviews conflicting reports from the same doctor as opposed to conflicting reports from different doctors? And in other words, if an ALJ is deciding between competing expert opinions, one can assume that part of that consideration boils down to intangible considerations, mm-hmm. like credibility, persuasiveness, expertise of the expert. But when the same doctor gives two different conflicting decisions, there are no issues of credibility or expertise. Doesn't a choice between the two opinions really demand a justification?
Well, that is precisely why the district court remanded in this case. It said the ALJ did not explain why she accepted this one opinion, and which the district court recognized that these were clearly inconsistent, that the one opinion said the claimant has no difficulties in social functioning and relates to others without problems. The other said she cannot relate to others and cannot interact with the general public. And the district court said, there's no explanation. I need an explanation. I am remanding so that she has the opportunity to provide the explanation. It did not reach the conclusion that the ALJ's decision to rely on the one opinion as opposed to the other was wrong. The court noted that there was some evidence that supported that the evidence was inconsistent. There was evidence that the ALJ did not cite that supported the restriction on interaction with the general public. There was other evidence that the ALJ didn't cite, which supported her conclusion that there were only mild limitations. It was specifically for this absence of a sufficient explanation. Not that that the conclusion the ALJ reached was necessarily wrong, but that she did, in fact, have to provide an explanation for these inconsistencies.
So what should happen now?
Well, what happens now is it is, in fact, remanded. The administrative law, under our rules, there is a need for an additional hearing. The claimant can submit additional evidence that was not available. The additional evidence might demand a finding of disability. The ALJ could say there's no change in the evidence. I believe I was right the first time, and here is my explanation for that. And at issue here is whether the district court properly exercised its discretion in saying, this one error is not, in my opinion, in this case, a reason for granting an award of EJIA fees. That in this case, to award EJIA fees would be tantamount for awarding fees simply on the basis of prevailing party status.
But that explanation is awfully cursory, isn't it? I mean, it's nearly impossible.
The district court's decision?
Yes.
The district. I do not advance the district court's EJIA decision as a model on which other district courts should use as a paradigm for their own EJIA decisions. But the standard in assessing a district court's EJIA decision is whether the record as a whole commands the conclusion that the district court was wrong. And the bones of the decision are there. And I think that examining, but without relitigating the underlying evidence, does not command the conclusion that the district court was wrong.
Are you arguing that the petitioner here was not a prevailing party?
No. No. That's not in dispute. She was a prevailing party. She submitted a timely petition for EJIA fees. The sole issue here is whether the district court properly exercised its discretion in denying the award of EJIA fees. And I should add that part of the standard is you look at the underlying record, but you do not relitigate the issues. The appellant spent a great deal of time saying that the district court ignored errors regarding moderate limitations and concentration. The district court's merit decision correctly or not, which is not subject to relitigation here, expressly found that the ALJ appropriately accommodated the limitations in concentration, persistence, and pace, and provided an acceptable explanation for her conclusion. That is at page, excuse me, I believe it's at page 13 of, no, it's at page, page 12. The ALJ gave the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt, limiting her to routine and repetitive work due to her alleged moderate problems with concentration, persistence, and pace. Thus, the ALJ explained her reasons and did not err in assessing plaintiff's limitation in that area. Now, again, that's the underlying merits decision. There is another aspect that has been brought up numerous times in five times in the reply brief, which is that the ALJ's decision ignored an entire line of evidence where the vocational expert had provided testimony that it would preclude jobs. That, I believe, is inaccurate. The ALJ here did, under the district court's decision, which we accept for purposes of this litigation, ignore a piece of a part of the litigation. At the administrative hearing, which appears at pages 425 to 428, when plaintiff's counsel cross-examined the vocational expert, he asked an additional hypothetical which imposed additional physical limitations, and then said, if we accept the physical limitations imposed by Dr. Holloway, the treating physician, are there jobs that the claimant could perform? The vocational expert said no. The district court expressly found that the ALJ did not err in assessing Dr. Holloway's opinion and did not err in assessing the claimant's physical residual functional capacity. The vocational expert was never asked about mental limitations beyond those in the administrative law judge's hypothetical, was never asked whether if the limitations in Dr. Holloway's second mental RFC opinion were imposed, whether there were jobs.
So how does that affect the ejectee question?
Well, I think there is some case law. First of all, there is case law, as counsel noted, regarding articulation, which basically suggests that errors in articulation are not fungible. Some errors may be fatal, may mean the government's position is not substantially justified. Others, which the court has recognized, where there is the possibility that there is substantial evidence in the record, or where the ALJ provided an explanation, albeit inadequate, the district court may exercise its discretion to deny the award of EJF fees. And in this instance, the district court noted that if the ALJ adopted on remand additional restrictions on mental restrictions, then she probably could not rely on the current VE testimony, because most of the jobs, although not all of them, all but one of the jobs, in fact, did involve interaction with the general public. So again, it is a question of the remand leaves open the possibility that the ALJ's conclusion was correct, that she simply did not provide an explanation based on the evidence in the record before her, and that she could come back with evidence in this record and provide a reasonable explanation, and that the government's position in advancing this case before the district court was reasonable.
So on the remand, though, under the rules, both sides are permitted to introduce additional evidence in support of it.
Certainly. It could be that in the time since the district court's since the remand, plaintiff's condition could have deteriorated, it could have improved, she could have seen a different doctor, there could be evidence that the ALJ never saw before that could result in a completely different decision.
So what about the fees?
Well, the point is that on the remand decision alone, the rule is certainly a plaintiff as a prevailing party who submitted a timely application, that Ms. Huber has crossed the threshold to the point where she can submit a petition for EJF fees. The district court then has a discretion to award or deny fees depending on its determination of the government's position, whether the position was substantially justified. In this instance, the district court said there was just this one reason, although it didn't cite Cunningham or it couldn't cite the Greaves or Thugenot cases, which were decided afterwards. It didn't cite the cases saying this is an error in articulation, an inadequate but existing decision. But it's clearly made, the district court, I believe, made clear that I remanded it for this reason. I didn't make any finding that dictated a conclusion that the ALJ was wrong. There was no strong or hypercritical language in the district court's opinion.
So what about the fees? I don't understand.
Well, the district court denied the petition for fees. It is the commissioner's position that the district court properly exercised its discretion.
That was
acceptable. That all the factors which support which this court uses in assessing a district court's decision. In other words, the same court decided both the merits and the EJIA decision. There was no strong or hypercritical language in the merits decision. There was no suggestion in the merits decision that the district court must have been wrong or that dictated a conclusion that she was wrong. The record as a whole does not command the conclusion.
But how much weight should we give to the fact that the same judge who remanded the case for an explanation as to why the ALJ chose one of Dr. Howard's opinions, but, you know, not the other, is the same judge who found the error did not warrant an award under the EJIA?
This court's cases in both in the recent Thubino case indicate that is a factor which favors a conclusion that the district court appropriately exercised its decision. There is an assumption that the district court, because it decided both issues, thoroughly understood the underlying record and said, I know what this error is. I'm paraphrasing. I know what this error is about. I don't think that this error justified an award of EJIA fees. I believe that the government position was substantially justified. So that is not determinative, but it is a factor that this court should consider in concluding that the district court properly exercised its discretion. So we respectfully request that the court uphold the district court's decision denying Ms. Huber's petition for fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act.
Thank you, Ms. Bennett.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Goldblum, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Ms. Goldblum.
Judge Rovner, let me start with your last question to government counsel. In the Hallmark case, the court held where it's not apparent that the district court applied the proper legal standard to form its conclusion regarding the justification of the government's position, deference to the district court does not end the court's inquiry. We maintain here that the district court did not apply the proper legal standards in terms of that finding of substantial justification. The district court's decision is very sparse. It notes that it remanded for this one issue. It says certainly the court found error is noted. It ordered remand because of that error. That makes plaintiff a prevailing party. It doesn't necessarily mean defendant's position was not substantially justified. Defendant bears the burden of persuading the court that its position was substantially justified. And it points out one of the cases that the defendant cited to, and then says after reviewing the case as a whole, the underside is of the opinion that the position of the government was substantially justified. To hold otherwise would equate prevailing party status with entitlement to fees. Well, no. First of all, the district court doesn't explain how it jumps from one to the other to make this finding that there was no lack of substantial justification. And furthermore, although perhaps the court wasn't satisfied that one error, although we think it was a pretty large error because the judge not only failed to explain, the judge failed to follow the agency's 96-8P ruling, but the district court doesn't pay attention to the fact that there was an issue that it never reached. And although counsel would say that we shouldn't be relitigating, if the district court is going to look at the case as a whole to decide if there's substantial justification, then it can't ignore the issue that it didn't reach because it already granted remand.
Had you, this is just for information purposes, had you submitted a request for the amount of fees?
Yes, we had. We submitted a petition in the amount of $8,224.50.
Thank you, Ms. Cole.
You're very welcome. We ask that you reverse the finding of the district court and remand the case for an award and calculation of benefits. We thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.